Good afternoon, everyone, and let me start by welcoming our executive panel that's joined us for this final session of the Experience Summit on Country System Strengthening. I think most of you know the folks who are sitting up here, but let me introduce them quickly, just so everyone's aware of who is here. We're very pleased that Don Steinberg, our Deputy Administrator, has joined us for this session. Sitting next to him is Susan Reichle, who you met yesterday, Assistant Administrator for Policy Planning and Learning Bureau. Glenn Anders is here this week, the acting head of the E3 Bureau, but is a former mission director in several countries and a wealth of experience. Maura O'Neill, our counselor for innovation and the head of our Office of IDEA, Innovation and Development Initiatives, Development Innovation Ventures. Greg Gottlieb, this week our acting assistant administrator for the Bureau of Food Security. Ariel Pablos Mendez, assistant administrator for the Bureau of Global Health. And Nancy Lindborg, Assistant Administrator for our DACHA Bureau, Democracy, Conflict, and Humanitarian Assistance. And again, I think it's a testament to the importance of the subject within the agency that we have been able to gather such a group of our senior policymakers at AID to hear what we've been talking about for the last day and a half, and to react to the discussion. So let me walk you through how the format of this is going to proceed. We're going to start with a summary report from Chip Walker, and I'll introduce Chip to the executive panel in a minute. And then we're going to follow with four short comments by folks who we've designated as sponges. Basically, they've been listening to the discussions over the last 2 days and have been taking in some of the comments, and we've asked them simply to react from their own perspective to what they've heard and where they'd like to see us proceed from here. And we've purposely invited two people from inside the agency and two people from our partner groups. And then we'll turn to the executive panel, starting with Don, for reaction, and then I will facilitate a conversation with my colleagues, asking them from their particular perspectives in the different bureaus that they represent and lead to react to some of the themes that they've heard in this conversation, as well as their own perspectives on the subject. But before we begin with the actual report, let me do, before I forget at the end of the day, just to thank a few of the key people who've been involved in making this two-day program incredibly successful. First and foremost, Chip Walker from our Bureau of Learning Evaluation Research, who really has been the conceptualizer of this Experience Summit, worked with the paper authors, worked with virtually everyone in this room, to really make this a tremendous success. So a big hand for Chip Walker. I also want to thank Ed Salt, our indefatigable facilitator. I don't know where Ed is right now, but very much appreciated all, oh, here he is, all his great work over the last couple of days. And you can see all the beautiful artwork on the walls, which Ed has made sure that we've put up and captured the discussions. And lots of others have been involved in, you know, running this. I want to thank the staff from QED for their efforts also in making this a success. And then on the just for folks to be aware. And as I said at the outset, we don't view this as the end of the process. This really is part of what we hope will be an ongoing partnership and consultation. We intend on producing what we're calling, an event report. We will distribute this by December 10th. So hold us to that deadline, Chip. he told me to use that date. So, but we're committed, and all of us know that the longer you wait to write up one of these reports, the harder it is actually to do. So I think we're all quite energized by what we've been talking about the last 2 days, and so we really want to get it out. The website that we've been using for this event will remain open, so if folks have other papers that they want to circulate through the website, we encourage you to do so. And again, we certainly want to encourage folks to provide feedback, you know, not necessarily here, but in any other manner through myself, through Chip, and others at the agency. So, again, this is an ongoing conversation. Our goal, as we said, is to produce a policy and program guidance document on country system strengthening, and, you know, I would hope it would be done in a couple of months, but I'm not going to say a date for that because I'm not going to be held accountable right now for a particular date. So let me start with Chip Walker. Again, those who've been here for much of the 2 days have already seen Chip in action. He did an extraordinary job of synthesizing yesterday's discussion and presenting a PowerPoint this morning, which captured much of what we had talked about yesterday, although as you would expect from a group like this, after he presented that synthesis of what we had discussed, the group came up with another half a dozen issues that were worthy of further discussion. But Chip, as I said yesterday, comes to this topic with lots of experience. For those who have read the full papers that we commissioned, you will see references to a work by S. Walker, which is Chip's name, and based on his work in the Cameroon during the 1980s and 90s, both as a researcher and as a USAID field officer, dealing obviously with some of the issues that we're talking about today. So the issue has been around for a while, and Chip has been engaged in this issue for quite some time. So with that, Chip, we invite you up to make some remarks on summarizing the discussion or highlighting some of the key points from the discussions of the last 2 days.
I think I'm going to just do it from here. So thank you very much. Obviously don't want to give you the same presentation over again that I gave this morning. So instead, this afternoon, what I'm going to do is to try to capture what we've been talking about over the last 2 days, and obviously not going to be completely successful in that given all of the work that we have done, but in the form of 7 headlines. So the first one is Summit Gathers 1,000 Years of Experience. We spent a lot of time being amused about the fact that collectively we have in this room well over 1,000 years of experience in development, some of them almost by themselves. But it was represented in a variety of ways from a variety of different audiences. We've had over 85 participants live here, approximately half of them from USAID and half of them from various of our partners, both non-governmental and for-profit, and a couple of researchers and think tank representatives. We had, for the opening session, over 25 people were online from different parts of the world, including 2 mission directors. We heard from both Bill Hammack from India and Cheryl Anderson from Ghana. We also captured that experience in 5 background papers, which we were provided before the event, as well as hearing from the paper authors during the course of the event, plus all of the opportunities provided during the afternoon yesterday and up through until the time you arrived today, really making hard use of all of the experience assembled in this room to help us not only sort of think through sort of the larger conceptual issues, but how do we move this forward practically to achieve some progress on country system strengthening. So the second headline is, it's the verbs that count. And this comes almost directly out of Dirk Dykerman's lead-off presentation yesterday, when he was pointing out the differences between using country systems on the one hand and strengthening country systems on the other. And we've had an ongoing conversation about what those mean and what the relationship is up through the end of the discussion. I think that one of the points about the using country systems, and this is the terminology that is generally used in international development circles, focuses very much on the flow of money and the flow of funds through financial systems. And I think that one of the points that was important to make is that part of what we're trying to do with country systems is essentially, if we really believe in it, is we need to trust them. And there's no other and better sense of trust than essentially providing the resources through the financial systems of our partners, whether governments or NGOs or private sector. At the same time, I think, and this was, I think, the consensus on where we came out, was that the strengthening country system has a broader scope, both in terms of not only using financial systems, but also thinking about how do we use other host country systems like planning systems, accountability systems and mechanisms, so it's not just simply financial, but also that it is more than government systems. And that it is all actors, both state and non-state, governmental and private, national and local, who are all sort of involved and implicated in producing a particular development outcome. So, for example, reducing child mortality or improving the level of primary education or something like that. So I think that as a general rule, I think that where we are right now is sort of an agreement that we need to pursue strengthening, recognizing that it is incorporating using as well. So the third headline is paradigm shift or turn of the screw. So this came out, again, part of what we've been doing with this experience summit is going back and looking at the evolution of aid thinking around these issues, sometimes dating back to the 1970s. And I think that one of the things that appealed to many was the fact that if you look at this, there's been a pendulum swinging back and forth and back and forth between engagements with government and then turning to moving around governments and so forth for various different, for a variety of reasons. So the question really is at this point, are we right now simply in a corrective to what has been and perhaps an over-reliance on approaches that bypass government? Or are we really involved in a paradigm shift? And for those who argue for the paradigm shift, I think the argument here is that what is different now is really bringing in systems thinking in the sense of thinking about systems as complex and adaptive and recognizing that seriously and embedding that into the way that we talk about country systems. So in that sense, it's more than just simply talking about a group when we talk about systems, but the way that they operate and some of the characteristics around it. So the fourth headline is civil society is a silo buster, or at least we hope so. So I think that one of the things that we've tried to do, and at least based on the people within this room, I think there's a strong belief that whether we are looking at system strengthening within the health sector or in the education sector, or whether we're talking about market systems, that we can use a common framework for talking about system strengthening, and that there are real advantages in doing so for no other reason than improving our learning and our ability to share insights across these various different approaches. The fifth one is that complexity does not mean impossibility. So we talked a lot about thinking seriously about systems and system strengthening requires a heavy dose of I'll come back to it. So that what we're really looking for is that it may be difficult, but we have lots of examples. Some of the examples cited in the paper, in the various papers, many of the examples from people around the room and from our various panelists about the fact that whether we call it system strengthening or not, that we are in fact doing what we think is necessary in terms of the way in which we engage with governments, in the way that we support government programs and so on. So that, but that one of the real difficulties that we have seen is, as we've moved this forward, is that it may seem a bit challenging, and therefore we need to highlight positives in the way we communicate about this as we go forward. The sixth one is a sort of a recognition that country system strengthening does in fact require changes in the way that we do business. Some of those changes were fairly major, is what came out of here, around, say, the skills that are required of our staff in the field, particularly things like foster skills and the ability to negotiate, to understand the system context. Some of them, the monitoring and evaluation requirements may shift, and that we need mechanisms that provide a greater degree of flexibility than many that are available to us at the moment. Other changes are needed, but perhaps less so, and those primarily are ones that are embedded in the program cycle. So we do need perhaps some thinking about how to embed more of an emphasis on dialogue in the strategic planning process, and how to really use project designs as a way to think about systems and how we bring together various kinds of mechanisms, not only contracts and grants, but also policy dialogue and things of that kind to address project objectives. And lastly, the point was made by several people that moving forward on this country systems strengthening agenda may be a very valuable and important vehicle for strategic communication in a variety of different environments. So, for example, with the international community, there may be real opportunities as we lay this out to build some stronger consensus. One of the things that was mentioned on a number of occasions is the extent to which there is still overlap in terms of donors sort of trying to do the same things in the same places. And so maybe there may be some possibility that we can use this as a vehicle for developing, say, a compact with some of our like-minded donors, but which would really take this issue of harmonization seriously, and perhaps we could get out of each other's way. There's also an opportunity for strategic communication. It was mentioned that we need to do a better job of engaging other parts of the U.S. government, and that this would really be a useful way of delivering on our various aid effectiveness commitments that have made in Busan and elsewhere. And lastly, in terms of our engagement with the Hill, I think there was a feeling that, to some extent, the shoe is pinching if we want to move forward from some of the restrictions that have been imposed on us statutorily, and therefore maybe we need to be negotiating with the Hill about changes in our operational space that would allow us to get some greater degree of flexibility, and that somewhere around that this system strengthening agenda may be a way to do so, but I think that the caution at the end was we may need different words to do this because some of the terms may not necessarily resonate with those communities.
Chip, a big round of applause. As everyone knows, it's not easy to pull, you know, all these different pieces together into seven headlines, and I think Chip has done a masterful job. I'd like to now call on our four commentators, starting with Larry Cooley from MSI. I think most folks know Larry, and we've asked him to be the first of our commentators.
Because I'm single-handedly 100 of the 1,000 years that are represented here. Let me just say a couple of things by way of introduction on this. One is that I think it's just terrific that AIDS is doing this again. For people with longish memories and who've been around this particular agency for a while, this was a characteristic of the agency that I think a number of us just really admired for a long time, and it's fallen into disuse. It's really nice to see it coming back. And the second thing is to say that I think it's honest to, in this case, say that the concept of partner was taken very seriously. And it's a pet peeve of mine that I think that word gets used very loosely in situations where it's really not applied, but this would be a case in which it really felt like it was. So I want to congratulate Aid on both of those fronts. I've been asked to do what Chip described as color commentary, And that's really a very self-indulgent thing to be able to do, and I'm going to take advantage of that. Some of it is stuff that I heard, and some of it's just stuff that I think. I'm going to make a few points on this, and I hope I won't offend, but I think I do better if I do this as candidly as I can. So I'm going to try and do that. The first issue has to do with cycles and trends. And my grandmother used to say it's hard to know a cycle from a trend, because when you're in the middle of it, it always looks like a trend. But in fact, a number of things cycle around, and so a lot of the discussion was, what are we rediscovering, and what are things that have really fundamentally changed? And at the beginning of the conversation, I was really struck by the rediscovery part, but the truth is, as time went on, I was more struck by the what's changed part of it. And I want to mention a couple of things in that regard, because I think they provide dimension to looking back at our own experience and figuring out when to resurrect it and when not to. We started out this kind of work years ago when we were one of very few donors. We were typically, and in many countries, the predominant donor, and we were also in a world where ODA was the dominant form of resource transfer. Neither of those things is the case today. We also were operating in a world where our own national security and political context more or less ignored us. We were kind of treated as grown-up Peace Corps on this. And maybe money was allocated based on countries with a kind of a Cold War mentality, but programs weren't designed that way. Now, when we look at things, including things like country system strengthening, there's a variety of different perspectives that are brought to bear on this. And so you sometimes get, to my mind, is a conflation or sometimes even a confusion of objectives competing for the same terrain. On a positive front, we started out this work some years ago in a situation where the countries, many of the countries we worked in, were really short of talented people. I won't say that's never the case now, but that's not the binding constraint, I don't think, in most of the countries where we work. So if we're bringing in expertise, it's not because there aren't smart people there. It's because there's either something distinctive that we can do, or there's some way that we have a comparative advantage of tackling some problem. And finally, and I think importantly, there's some growing global consensus. There are platforms that exist now that didn't exist before. Bhutan is a classic case of that. So there's a certain imperative that gets picked up by those things and carried along. And I think those differences are in some ways more compelling almost than the similarities to our own past experience. That said, I think there's some really useful things to draw from where we were. And in particular, I think there's a very interesting issue of what we can do as an independent actor in trying to intervene in this situation. I want to turn to that as my second point. That's the issue of comparative advantage. In this discussion about where U.S. can benefit host country systems by using them and by doing other things to strengthen them, I think there was an honest effort in the room to try and figure out not just what the systems need, but what we as a country bring that perhaps others don't bring in the same measure. And I wouldn't pretend that there's a consensus in the room on that, but I think that's an important conversation for people to continue having. I'll tell you my own personal point of view. I'm not characterizing this as a group point of view at all. I think we have a really strong comparative advantage on things that involve actually helping those systems, not just funding the systems, but helping them. We've spent 40 or 50 years investing in the wherewithal to try and do that. Most of the other countries that are trying to deliver assistance haven't done so. And so where there's help that's needed, I think the U.S. does itself and does the countries a favor by raising its hand and saying, we can help. Not we're offering help you didn't ask for, but if there's help that's needed, we're in a position and we're well equipped to try and provide that kind of help. And one of the places I think that particularly plays out is in accountability systems. Because we've talked a lot about the need for that as part of making these sorts of approaches work. And countries are a little bit disinclined to invest in that. Not resistant, but disinclined. And so given a little bit of encouragement and a little bit of help, it struck me that that was a place we could be of enormous value to them. Another place that I think we have a real potential is in countries that are coming out of a conflict or problematic situation. Those are windows of opportunity that are open for relatively short periods of time. They want and need help. And it's not just money. At that point, they really want expertise to try and help sort out a problem. It seems to me that's another situation in which we as a country are well constituted to try and be of service. Going to a third point. There were, and I think this is problematic but not debilitating, there were really two different conversations going on in this room over the last couple of days, in my opinion. One is the kind of IPR discussion that focuses on systems in the sense of the country's financial management systems, particularly in procurement systems. The other was the kind of systems thinking, which is things like the healthcare system or the food security system or the public welfare system. That's a different use of the word system. They interact, but it's a very different use of the word system. And if you were to take a moment and peruse the things across the walls here, you would find both of those well represented. But when we weren't careful, we talked past each other, I thought, quite substantially on that issue. And so as we talk about host country systems and strengthening them and using them, I think we need to be really clear what we're talking about and what imperative we're trying to respond to. The fourth point I'd make has to do with the danger, I think, of a disconnect between diagnosis and action on this. Some of the words that you heard a lot, if you were here the last couple of days, were complex, context-dependent, a whole series of things that make the environment very, very unwieldy, or at least hard to get your head around. We can't allow ourselves to get paralyzed there, because if we were to fall into that do loop, we'd end up talking to ourselves and nobody would end up listening. So somewhere very quickly we need to go from understanding complexity or acknowledging complexity to acting in a complex world. And the discussion, and a substantial part of the discussion, I think, to its credit, tried to find a way to cut through that, to say, how do you move very quickly from an analytical frame of mind, call it a social science frame of mind, to a change management frame of mind on this. And I would just point out one thing from my own point of view on that, and that is there's a differentiation, I think, between analysis and engagement on this. And I think it's tempting to do the analysis first and the engagement second, but I think that's the wrong sequencing. I think it's the engagement first and the analysis second, because it fundamentally transforms who's doing the analysis and the way that analysis is framed. Can I make one more point? Okay. The final point that I'll make has to do with a willingness to invest in systems. It seems to me the concomitant to a decision that systems matter is that when systems have problems, we are, as a country, or we as a donor community, are prepared to make investments alongside them in terms of trying to improve those systems. And I'm nervous as we've moved more and more to earmarked programs and to a situation where the latitude to do that is circumscribed, that there's going to be a substantial disconnect between our ability to name the problem and our ability to help solve it.
Thanks, Larry. Those are great points. Now I'm going to call on one of our inside USAID commentators, Laura Pavlovich from the DACHA DRG Center, recently in from the field where she was serving in Ukraine. Laura's over there, so if someone has a microphone, please provide her.
Thanks. I think I'm going to take a slightly different take from Larry. I think his comments were actually fantastic. I'm going to speak a little bit more from an operational perspective, having worked on issues of capacity building and development, as Larry mentioned, in the field and much more recently here in D.C. I think, you know, the discussion over the past couple of days on systems-based approaches has been fabulous. I think the simplest and the most fundamental formulation was one that somebody, I think, flip-charted this morning about strengthening country systems for what? And, you know, in the discussion that the breakout discussion I was in this afternoon, we were talking about the desired end state, which I think it was Khan actually put very elegantly as governments delivering services effectively, transparently, and accountably. And that's great, but how do we get there? And I think, you know, kind of reflecting back on the papers and the discussions we've had over the last couple of days, one piece that I was really happy to see filtered through in a number of the papers that, you know, Derek and John and Felix's papers, but also in the discussions yesterday, was the importance of understanding the political context of the work that we're trying to do. And I think Derek was talking about, you know, identifying the constituencies and enabling them to create the space to inform development processes. At the same time, a number of folks have talked about the importance of building accountable systems. And I think as the ultimate policy coming out of these past couple of days has fleshed out, I think it's critical to think about these concepts of accountability but also responsiveness, and not to lose sight of the ultimate beneficiaries of our work, obviously the citizens. We both should be informing the approaches and holding the partner countries accountable for the for the quality and the effectiveness of the services that are being delivered. Kind of stepping back and talking in terms of, as a DRG officer who's worked in, countries at both ends of the development continuum, I think it's really important to note that focusing on strengthening country systems, whether that's in the sense of the public financial management side or looking more at a sectoral level, and more importantly, trusting the systems that we're investing in, really is a big shift in terms of how we've done business. And I think the ultimate policy that we've begun to discuss can be extremely helpful to the extent that it can flesh out how we engage in strengthening country systems holistically across our development portfolio. What we've been talking about in terms of system-based approaches, speaking as a technical officer now, is a pretty radical shift from the stovepipe way that we've been addressing programming. And I think it's important that, not only that we talk about, how we change the way that we design activities, but also that we keep in mind that, the development, the specific development context that we're working in. I mean, Dirk really put it out well this afternoon in terms of looking at strengthening country systems along a continuum of development. What you would be doing in a fragile state looks considerably different from what you would be doing in India. I think that doing this type of work is going to require a whole of mission approach, and something that I think a lot of folks have talked about, but I think that's critically important to remember as we implement this, is that when we talk about whole of mission approach, it's mission defined extremely broadly. It's not just the mission itself. It's not just our implementing partners, but it's also other donors. It's also the host country governments, and most importantly, the host country governments that we're working with. In developing projects that really address the systems within which we work. And I think, the other thing that we've talked about, but I think it's really important that, we can use this strategy to inform, is developing a learning agenda that is able to quickly but, effectively document and rapidly process lessons learned. I do think that this is a paradigm shift in terms of how we do business. It's an extremely exciting paradigm shift, but I think it's something that we've got a lot of work to do, and I'm looking forward to working with colleagues both, within and outside the agency, and addressing.
Thanks, Laura. That was great. Now turn to our third commentator, Carrie Diener from Mercy Corps. Carrie's right over here. Could you give her the microphone? Carrie, thanks for agreeing to do this.
Great. Thanks. First of all, thank you so much to the organizers and the participants for a very engaging 2 days. And I think it was interesting for me personally, too, because I'm also coming off a six-month process of doing an internal reflection within Mercy Corps about what partnerships and local ownership means for us. And we've talked to people in a number of countries, and so I think it's been very interesting to bring those reflections and local voices back into my participation over the past 2 days and into the conversation. So while I can't capture everything, I'd just like to expand on three themes that really stood out for me over the past 2 days. And the first theme is that in dealing with systems, I think that USAID really needs to move away from linear thinking and embrace more of an iterative programming approach to respond to emerging needs and really fluid reform context, places like Tunisia, those of the world, Burma. And I think, this shift is really challenging because we need to show results, particularly to Congress. And, perhaps we just need to be more honest as a community about failures with those who hold the purse strings, and you really see them as part of the road to strengthening systems and highlighting the value of these failures as learning tools. And in further exploring this theme, I think it's also quite interesting to understand why some organizations, be they businesses, government, why they say no to USAID and U.S. government funding. I think this type of analysis might be interesting and would help USAID begin to stretch beyond its comfort zone and to look at what it might take to bring new types of actors to the table, be they social movements, networks, universities, et cetera. The second theme that I saw come out was that we need to get the what of partnerships right. And I think that we need to do this before delving into the how or the mechanics. So if the objective is to really truly expand local ownership, then this will require assessing needs, planning interventions, and orienting partnerships in a really fundamentally different way. So in other words, we have to avoid this projectization of local ownership, and that was a theme that came out very strongly in several of the panels. So local ownership shouldn't just be a matter of finding local implementers for otherwise standard U.S. solicitations, and if it is, then we should be explicit about that. But I think what's highlighted is that we're finding partnerships for other reasons, and many presentations highlighted the fact that local actors in developing countries are looking for partnerships that advance their goals. They're not seeking to simply be an implementing partner alone, and they really want to develop as institutions. They see partnerships as a means for building their credibility and sustainability, and also their credibility with other donors through technical expertise. And I think the point that even the most vulnerable communities have systems was really critical, and how do we bring these voices into the dialogue and these systems into the dialogue. I liked the idea of an inclusive dialogue as a starting point for the development of a new business model and project structure. And I think this afternoon we discussed how that could be within reach, you know, with the new technology tools, things like crowdsourcing, et cetera. And I think it's really notable that in our study, in our discussion with partners in a number of countries, I would say that the majority of them had never heard about USAID Forward. And these are very savvy and sophisticated local organizations, businesses, and very knowledgeable government officials. So I think that's notable in itself. And then I think the third theme for me was that really donors are part of the system whether or not they like it or not. And so we need to turn the mirror around and look at donors as part of the system. And given that, we need to really explore together, you know, whether or not donors like USAID can effectively play a facilitator role or if they're too embedded in the system and the process itself. I think there's a real danger in uncoordinated donor interventions, adding additional stress to already challenging policy and reform processes and systems. Take Burma as an example. This is a place where rapid reforms are happening. If we intervene in an uncoordinated way, we could exacerbate some of the issues there and add further stress to an already chaotic reform environment.
Thanks, Carrie. That was great. And our fourth commentator is Karen Kavanaugh from the Office of Health System Strengthening in the Bureau of Global Health at USAID. Karen?
Thank you. I can honestly say I've never had the distinction of being the fourth sponge, so this is a new role for me. I wanted to start with just a few things that to me were, I would say, my favorites, just as nuggets. One was a favorite new word, rinky-dinkism, which is doing things on such a small scale that they just don't add up, something that we want to avoid in our approach. My favorite new definition of capacity building, someone said, is a supply-driven bottomless pit. So I thought that was interesting. But I would also say that I have a favorite story from the meeting, and that actually is something that I think illustrates well the time lag and the unpredictability of working on systems, and that is the story of a program that supported Kenyan exchange students that in the long run gave us our own president, so I thought that was quite interesting. I don't think they necessarily put that in their annual report, but it's an interesting example of how you can have unintended positive consequences with a great time lag. Well, long time, yes, indeed. So just one insight, we had many that were shared, but one that I thought is very important is the notion that our work takes place in a historical context that matters. We're in the post-9/11 era, post-USSR, post-ICT revolution, in an environment of rapid economic growth of our partner countries, and shifting global roles for different countries. And those things are going to be important in whatever kind of systems approach that we take. But I wanted to concentrate on what I thought were some very practical, actionable recommendations that were given by the participants. One, which I heard and also read in the papers, is start somewhere. The fact that you have a systems approach doesn't mean you take on the whole system. It means you look at the whole system, understand the whole system, and then you start somewhere. Where you have a comparative advantage, where the country has the greatest interest in support, but start somewhere. Another was enhanced feedback loops, and countries want feedback from us, and we have a responsibility to give that. And in many ways, I think one of AIDS' comparative advantages is improving the availability of information that gives countries those feedback, strengthens those feedback loops. Another is, this I think came from the mission director in India. We should be working with other partners who put their own money on the table to design shared solutions. And I don't know if we want to call those projects, but shared solutions. And focus not only on corporate social responsibility, but really on viable business models, where we're working on something that will be sustainable, where the other players have a vested interest in the long-term sustainability of that. And we should start with a clear exit plan, or as some people prefer to look at, start with a clear transition plan, so that we begin our engagement thinking about how we will, how and when we will end it or transition to a different form of relationship with our partner country. Then the practical suggestion that came from the Ghana mission director, for every country system that we use in some way, we should have a plan for strengthening it. So if we had that as basically a general rule for our work, that might be a helpful place to introduce that as an action step. And another is we have a huge track record of strengthening country systems. And I think our partners from the countries, including the mission director from Central Asia, pointed out we're doing a lot of really interesting things already. Let's learn what we're already doing, study that, and share those lessons. And then finally, the importance of engaging in the policy dialogue if we're going to be working on systems. So that's my contribution as the fourth sponge.
Well, let's give a big hand to Larry, Terry, Laura, and Sharon. So now we're going to turn to our panel, and again, I think you've heard an incredible array of reactions to what we've been discussing over the last 2 days, and you know, I think everyone is looking forward to hearing, you know, how the folks from inside AID at the senior executive level respond to some of these issues, both from the specific perspective of what you've heard and more generally from some of the issues that you're engaged in. So I'm going to start with our Deputy Administrator, Don Steinberg.
Yeah, first of all, thank you for your participation. This has been, I've been getting the feedback every 20 minutes, it seems like, from various participants. And indeed, you know, we have an expression we use at AID, which is that no one has a monopoly on good ideas, on financial resources, on ground truth, or on moral authority. And the contributions that everyone has been making demonstrate that. I'm actually a little intimidated because there are a number of people in the room who taught me everything I know about development. I'm tempted to say I feel like the guy who was asked to talk about whale anatomy and looked out in the audience and saw Jonah sitting there. And in fact, I think there are a lot of Jonahs in this audience right now. What I'm particularly encouraged about is that the discussion over the last couple of days was about how and what and where and to some extent why, but not about whether. And I think that's a clear understanding that we all have that it is a new world out there. Our development partners in the field, whether they're governments, whether they're civil society, whether they're business communities, are not going to accept a paternalistic policy from donors, from international NGOs, from contractors anymore. They're demanding control over their own development drives, and you know, policies made in Washington or Brussels or Beijing, for that matter, just aren't going to fly. I think we also, as Larry was suggesting earlier, we're facing a much different world out there. Just to put a couple numbers on what Larry was talking about, we're at the highest level that we've ever been as a donor, officially in terms of development assistance. We're at $30 billion from the U.S. government, about 60% of that from AID. As you all know, that's still less than 1% of our national budget. That's a talking point I know we all have. But by comparison, we've got $39 billion that is generated from NGOs, from church groups, from universities in the development field. We've got $100 billion that is coming in terms of remittances from people in the United States to developing countries. And overall, there's $1 trillion worth of foreign investment going into these countries. It used to be, you know, when I started out, it was 15% of the resources came from areas other than development assistance. Now, development assistance is about 15% of the total resources. And so we're in a much different world where we just cannot pretend that we're doing things in old ways. The other key point to remember is that we're seeing this flood of democracy around the world where we are now dealing with countries whose governments truly reflect the will of their people, and they understand the need to reach out to those communities. When the Berlin Wall fell, we had three democracies we were dealing with in Africa. Today we've got 20, and these are our key development partners out there. Paradoxically, as we all know, there is a contrast between that and a closing of space for civil society in a number of countries around the world that we're very concerned about. And indeed, the use of our leverage with these countries to encourage them to continue to work with civil society and to build that space is very important. The other thing that you've been talking about that I find just fascinating is the question of donors as part of the system, as having to look at their own comparative advantages, because we never used to. We used to be able to go into a country and do what we wanted to do, and we generally get the World Bank on our side and maybe link up with the Europeans a little bit and proceed on our way. Now we're having to look at, you know, the U.S. not being the 600-pound gorilla, but, you know, how can we use convening authority to draw people together? How can we reduce risk for private sector or for the host government or for civil society? How can we take that risk ourselves? Because in many cases, we've got broader shoulders than a civil society group or a local government. How can we be the catalyst for partnerships? And indeed, I like the comment a lot about looking at partnerships more carefully, because I'm tired of stopping a public-private partnership on any engagement that USAID does with a private company or an NGO, and then making it immune from tough criteria of effective development. It isn't gift money anymore. It is the money that we need to do development. We need to look at us as filling specific financial gaps. We need to look at the U.S. government role in establishing agendas in norm setting. And this is a much different world. Now, the only thing I wanted to add at the end is that even as we adjust, the NGO community has to adjust. The American business community has to adjust. The private contractors that we deal with, the international financial institutions. This is a brave new world that we're dealing with, and we're all going to have to work together to figure out our specific roles in this. But the single last point I wanted to make is we're not doing this from a position of weakness. I believe we have the strongest constituency in the United States right now for international development that we've ever had as a country, because I think it has extended beyond simply it's the right thing to do, that we, because of our moral values, want to live in a world that's peaceful and democratic and prosperous and respectful of human rights and human dignity. It's also important that our business community and our workers know that prosperity abroad means prosperity for the United States. They know, even if they don't know the number, that 13 of our top 20 fastest growing markets overseas are current or former aid recipients. They know that that means jobs in terms of exports, export opportunities, investment opportunities, et cetera. But equally important is the question of the impact of all of this on our national security. Because I think it is well understood now that countries that are prosperous and respectful of human rights don't tend to traffic in drugs, in weapons, in people. They don't send out large numbers of refugees across borders or across oceans. They don't harbor terrorists or pirates. They don't transmit pandemic diseases. And they don't require American troops on the ground. I used to quote General Petraeus to audiences. I think I'm going to, well, I'll do it anyway. He came to USAID and he said, you know, we're not going to fight our way out of Afghanistan. We're going to develop our way out of Afghanistan. And I think that is well understood. And so that brave new world, I'm just really pleased that you're making such an incredible contribution to helping us understand our role, your role, and how we can work together.
Thanks, Don. That was great. And it is a brave new world. So I'd like to ask my colleagues who are on this panel to react to some of what it is they've heard. Let's start, Yancy, with you, because you and I and Chip had a conversation a couple of weeks ago, I think, that inspired us, but also, as you heard, was reflected in some of the discussions here, which is understanding the country context and the different country context, specifically with respect to fragile states, which I know you've taken on in the context of post-Busan. But also, and I'm not sure it was mentioned or highlighted as much in the report outs, but certainly was part of the discussion, where does, resilience fit into this whole discussion? So, Nancy, start with you.
Congratulations for the event, Chip and Larry, I got really excited when we had the conversation a week or so ago. Because, I sit in the DACHA Bureau, Democracy, Conflict, Humanitarian Assistance, which is basically looking at what happens when systems are really broken, either because they've been disrupted by shock, by crisis, by chaos. The fragility sends countries over and over again into cycles. And what I think is very exciting about this is, particularly in those situations, you cannot use any sort of single point solutions to enable development gains to be back in train. And Larry, I like your idea about differentiating between a systems approach and using the systems. And what I think we have an interesting opportunity right now, looking at both the resilience agenda that has really emerged with significant momentum over this past year in response to just repeated crises and droughts, in particular in places like the Horn of Africa and the Sahel, as well as looking at what we have with the whole Fragile States New Deal, is that both of them take a systems approach. They understand that you've got the country's systems with the international system, and together that's the system that we're working with, but that you have to use a systems approach, use the country systems to get to the solution. So it's really a both. It's a knitted together approach. And one of the things I'm really struck by is, we had a lot of 50th anniversaries this last year. We had AIDS 50th anniversary, Peace Corps, Danita, and I'm so struck by the fact that we have really been at this enterprise for about 50 years now, and during that time have consistently sought new solutions. It's the cycles and trends thing. But the result has been this proliferation of solutions that are increasingly separated from one another. And we have tons of institutions that are more and more narrowly defined in what they do. And what I think we have right now, whether it's a trend or a cycle or a spiral, which is another option, is an effort to break through that and move towards this approach that understands that even to start now, whoever used that, requires that understanding of the whole and how all of these, the context and the drivers of, in the case of both the resilience and the Fragile States New Deal, how they all exist within a complex system. So the opportunity we have with those two frames, the resilience agenda and the Fragile States New Deal, is that both provide a framework that brings together a multitude of development partners working in partnership with effective country frameworks that create mutual accountability opportunities and also look at very specific ways forward with shared and aligned approaches. So I'm very optimistic about what that means for our ability to try to address the ways that, you know, the billion people who will not reach the Millennium Development Goals, or, you know, the 13 billion people in the Horn and 18 billion people in the Sahel that went into yet another cycle of drought this past year, that until we're able to get at those fundamental fragilities and vulnerability to shocks, we can't move forward. And to move forward, we need to have the systems approach. You can just give bed nets out till ever, but that won't get at the heart of the vulnerabilities that we're looking at. Two other quick points I would make is part of a systems approach, and this picks up on one of Don's points, is it's inclusive. And where we see a lot of systems fail is when they are exclusive of people, of geographies, of the dry lands in Kenya, of women, et cetera. And so it's baked into this approach is that you need to have that inclusive vision of what we're trying to accomplish. And then the final point, I really liked the comments that were made about investing in accountability systems because that is what enables us to work in partnership and to take the risks. The United States is working with Sweden to support Liberia as a pilot country in the Fragile States New Deal. And the Minister of Finance in Liberia likes to say, you know, we know our pipes leak, but let's use them together and fix them together. And so it's acknowledging that there will be problems, but making the commitment to be accountable to work in partnership to fix them. And I think that's a good motto for us. Thanks.
Thanks, Nancy. Ariel, you've been thinking about this issue of system strengthening and also applying it in terms of the Bureau of Global Health. I'd love to hear your reactions to what you've heard and also the directions that you see forward in the health sector.
Well, thank you. Thank you all. It's been music to my ears, everything that I've been hearing here. In health, we have been subject to the pendulum, and the drivers have been macro changes in the political economy, and then all the technical details change. It used to be called tropical medicine in the first half of last century. With the end of European colonialism in Africa and Asia, we became international health. And this was an era where we had a strengthened role of governments. Actually, it was pretty much a governments conversation in the midst of the Cold War. And it also changed, and the opportunities for being systemic happened in our space. With the end of the Cold War, or coinciding with the end of the Cold War, we entered what we now call global health. And in the global health era, it has been quite a vertical and successful era for global health because of resources and impact, but it was indeed more vertical. And we believe we are now entering a new era. We don't have a name yet for this new world health, but it's also being shifted again because of the changes in the big political economy, not so much the recession in the rich countries as the incredible development success of what you used to call many of the developing world. And we heard about that right now. I want to make a point that systems are fractal and that even some of those vertical silos have to be systemic in their thinking to be successful. And they have. I mean, the incredible mobilization around HIV/AIDS could not have happened unless there was systemic forces in it. So it's always about recognizing what is the sweet spot, what is the angle, what is the timing, to be transformative at scale and sustainable for a purpose. And I think that this can be done in so many ways, and I think in the papers there was a reflection of that. In health, the specifics of these macro changes we are referring to as the economic transition of health, which Don referred to, yes. The role of USAID vis-a-vis the total ODA, the role of ODA vis-a-vis the total capital inflows, and the role of ODA in health vis-a-vis the total health expenditure within countries, all driving down very fast. A success in so many ways. Also success in health has been dramatic, actually. So dramatic that we are now moving to envision bold end games, not slogan, or when we talk about ending preventable child death, we mean it. In a generation, we are going to bring down the levels of the world together. We'll bring down the levels of child mortality down to the levels that we see in OECD countries today. This is happening already. Mortality for mothers, likewise. So bold end games are now becoming possible because of the success of the development enterprise and the global health enterprise. For us, of course, we have been doing a lot. And I came to USAID from the Rockefeller Foundation only a year and a half ago. And I came because USAID had been a lead in health systems all along, especially when you look at the numbers of money, the National Health Accounts, among many other platforms of USAID and information systems and so on. So it is the place for systems approach. And we are now establishing an office for health systems that recognizes that position has strengthened all of that work across many of the elements and many other offices and across networks in our missions. I liked also from Chip just the major points about the last 2 points on capacity and communications. I think that both in our staff and in the communities, we do not have all the skill sets or the latitude because we are often so busy just managing the project and the deliverables of the project that we often need the opportunity to leverage those investments for systems transformation, and that need is going to grow in importance. And likewise on communications. I think communicating with the Hill and with our taxpayers is very important. Both the evidence and the arguments in our case for health system strengthening, of better health outcomes, of poverty alleviation, of sustainability, and we all need to work together on that. It is not easy to communicate health systems, I have to say, because I used to work in many other areas before, vaccines, AIDS, tuberculosis. It's harder with a crosscut like health systems. And the communication challenge had morphed this community in the global health to now look at the actual state we're after, which is access for all to appropriate health services at an affordable cost. That is the definition of universal health coverage. And now, next month, there is now a resolution before the General Assembly of the UN to have a high-level meeting on the very topic. Quite systemic, but with a goal, with a purpose, to bring, like the Toyota people would think, a true north concept that informs all of the decisions of the many actors towards a bigger purpose. And I only mention that all because Larry also made a point about two currents that sometimes crossed during the meeting, which was the financing systems and then the health systems and other systems. And I think a common link there is taxation. And we need to be much better at looking how we work taxation. As our role, as we are not only 1% of the federal budget, but less and less, perhaps less than 1% of the social spending in many of the countries we work in, our window to leverage the system transformation for equitable and more efficient systems is dwindling. And clearly, one of the axes of the pivots is going to be tax systems. As we are witnessing in these countries, because often reform efforts, systemic reform efforts, as in the case of healthcare, requires a renegotiation of social tax, as we are experiencing in these countries. And that, of course, is similarly in challenge in many other countries, although it's easier to reform 5% of an economy than 18% of an even bigger economy. So we see those as possibilities, and USAID is really as a key platform, well-positioned already. We look forward to working with all of you. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ariel. Greg, from your perch in the Bureau of Food Security front office, as well as your, in this panel, relative veteran status at AID, if you could talk a little bit about, in response to Chip's comment about, you know, requiring changes in how we do business, you know, in the food security context, and also picking up again on Chip and Ariel's point about the skills that we need and what you're observing in terms of, you know, moving in the directions we're talking about, where are some of the gaps that you see existing?
Thanks, Larry. Nancy mentioned 50 years, and when I was getting into this business, the guy that helped me get into it said to me, it's a 100 years experiment. And he was talking from back in the 40s, so if you go back to when he started this, we've only got about 35 years left. So we really are going to have to get going here if we're gonna make good on that claim. But I do think that one of the interesting things about the papers was that it really sort of showed up some of the things that Larry talked about, whether it's a trend or it's a cycle. But clearly there are things that we're doing now that we thought about doing before. And perhaps we've got better analytical tools that enable us to take advantage of moving money through governments. And also the way that those countries have changed, the strengthening of personnel that make it more possible for us to succeed in investing in those systems. And I think that since I came back to do Feed the Future and start this Bureau for Food Security, one of the areas that we started at, one of the key things, principles, was this had to be country-driven. So many of us have probably done a lot of programs in which we've said, oh, yeah, this is completely country-driven. And I think we, in the past, were such heavyweights that country-driven had, it was probably a bit tongue-in-cheek, perhaps. I think the process that we've gone through in Feed the Future have shown us that we can, because we are not so big anymore, we really do have to engage on with a much more country-driven plan. And Nancy talked about the resilience, and she and I have actually been engaged with this for a while now, and I've been leading the group, this global alliance in the Horn of Africa, and we just concluded a group, we had about 16 of us go out to the Horn and talk with the Kenyans and the Ethiopians about their plans. And I think that to me that what that showed to me was that as all of our influence declines, it's not just our influence, but that of the Europeans and that of other donors declines, we need to be pulling together. And that was, I think, one of these issues was several people, I think, Carrie, you brought this up, and that is the what of the partnership. So we're talking about You were talking about local organizations, which we, of course, when we get to an emergency situation, we find the group that can do it for us, and we all pile our money onto them, and, of course, we inundate them and drown them. And I think what we have to start doing is, if we're going to really make a difference, and we're, you know, with resilience, we've been working in these dry areas, but I think it applies to a lot of things, is we really have to get our donor money really close together, because as we occupy smaller and smaller space, if, as Larry said, its complexity is not impossibility, so if you want to attack the system problem, you want to jump into it somewhere, we could, you know, like Karen, you said, we have to jump in somewhere. The question is, what's the size of our splash that we make? For those of you who are, you know, keen on diving and those kinds of things. Having been a diving judge, I know you don't want a big splash. But the fact is that in what we do, we want a big splash. Because, and the problem is just jumping in where we go is, if you look at the whole system, you just can't tell that you're going to have the impact you want. And I think that's going to be a key for a lot of what we do. The more that we can work with other donors on that to really have a more comprehensive influence and program, it will be better for us. So that's really what I see as important. And the other thing I think is, we talked about trends versus cycles and whatnot, and I do think that we have to use our analytical abilities to understand what those trends are, and decide, do we want to support those trends? Some of those trends may go against our grain, but I know that in the Horn of Africa, we look at what's happening in the dry lands and we say, there's a growing commercialization of livestock. It threatens a traditional way of life, and there are many of us that worry about that. But the fact is that if we're going to dig ourselves out of that hole, spending billions of dollars every few years, maybe that's a trend that we have to support and push and be part of. So I do think that a lot of things that I heard from the sponges, I think were very telling, and I think are going to provide us with the kinds of things that we need to think about how we want to push our programs in the future. So thanks, Larry.
Great. And Laura, you know, one of the issues that came up repeatedly was this whole issue of public-private partnerships, which, again, I know you've thought a great deal about, and I also know you've thought about way back when you were doing your thesis about complexity and those issues. So I wonder if you could offer some reflections on what you've heard and where you see this heading from a USAID perspective.
Great. Well, thank you, Larry, and thank you so much for everybody to be so thoughtful. And I know we just got a snapshot of some of the wisdom that was shared over the last couple of days. So I guess I'd start where Larry Cooley talked about, and that is our new reality of going from when we were the people that could create our own future to now these multiple objectives. And he specifically talked about the military, but let me add a few ones because I've had the benefit of being in many interagency meetings. So it's our national security, it's trade, it's jobs in the U.S., it's climate, it's economic growth, it's transparency, it's a number of these things. And I think that while some of us would like to yearn for the old days where things were simpler. In fact, I would argue that all of us ought to look at these as opportunities rather than get focused on frustration and resentment for the fact that there are these multiple objectives that can at times be conflated. And I'll use an example. Procter & Gamble now says that 40% of their jobs in Ohio are related to their global business. And so I do believe that one of the things like I'd like to add to this conversation is that HSBC, which is a global bank based in London, says that 70% of all economic activity in the next 40 years will come from the emerging nations. But what we know is that that will not happen unless there are stable governments, that there is an adequate infrastructure, and that consumers, people in those countries, and producers are ravaged by disease. And there's no one country or one company that can do it. And so I do believe that the new kinds of public-private partnerships will emerge, are moving from corporate social responsibility to profit and loss. And so just as Greg said, the notion of things that may have felt more uncomfortable, smallholder farmers and how do they fit into a global food supply chain that provides more food security for everybody in Mozambique and more export cash for their economy. And I think that too, I hadn't thought about my dissertation, but my dissertation was about, I discovered how narrow-mindedness happens in our brains and therefore in our decision making. So I would encourage all of us to get outside of our silos and to mash up people who think very differently, who have different backgrounds. And then one last thing I would say. Exactly. So I'm really heartwarming to say, to hear the notion that we start with the exit in mind or clear transition. Because I believe when I uttered those words at AID, that I was stripped naked and run down Pennsylvania Avenue 3 years ago. And so I'm very pleased that those are conversations that we're courageous and bold enough to have right now. And I think will ultimately lead us to catching up after 70 years so we can make that 100-year goal. And the notion that we're not going to get it right, that it is complex, and we have to start somewhere, and we just have to iterate, and we have to change our processes, our thinking, our contracting processes, our relationships with our partners, so that we assume that there will be corrections to the course and iterations, and we make that more easy and more timely to do. Thank you.
Thanks, Mara. Glenn, you're probably you are on this panel, the person who has the most recent mission director field experience, and so we'd love if in the course of your remarks you could react to this from the perspective of someone who just came back from, one of our largest missions in Indonesia.
Thank you. I'm pretty humbled by sitting up here talking with people like Larry and Ed, who taught me my management skills, and my mentors like Carol Peasley and Emmy Simmons, so I'm not quite sure how much I can add. I certainly haven't disagreed with much I've heard. But I'm old enough to remember Peter McPherson's four pillars, one of which was institution building. We talked a lot about strengthening country systems back then, and somehow we've lost our way over time, and it's great that we're back into it. It's been a rather wretching experience for me. I'm not a very good representative of the E3 Bureau because it was a wretching experience being pulled out of being a field person and running a field mission into what is essentially, technical support and hoping to be a technical leadership bureau within the agency. And it's about as far from country systems as you can be.
of course, there was some method in Eric Postel's madness in bringing me in, because what he has set me up as is to be that person to ask about country ownership and to ask about the country systems, because, of course, that's part and parcel of what you do as a mission director in the field. In listening to everything and reading the background material, I thought the paper that resonated with me most, and much of what I've heard here, was Dinah Brown, if I pronounced the name correctly. But I would boil it down to three points rather than the six here. The first, as it's been said, is it's a long-term commitment. That we can't, you know, even our projects that we do, the challenges and all, with a 2 to 3 year a life of project, we've got to think about sustainable tails and where that goes from there, because we know these things take institution building takes 5-10 years. I mean, I've been in countries as new as Eritrea and as old as Indonesia, where we celebrated actually 60 years of foreign assistance. When we tried to do our 50-year ceremony, the Indonesians informed us, oh, no, so you've been here 60 years, of course, before AID was there. However, just to show you how stodgy we were, we had never done an RFA in Bahasa, Indonesia, in 60 years in a country. So how could we be inclusive? How could we bring in? And as our deputy administrator well knows from his visit there, there's a tremendous feeling among much staffers, well, we're already doing country systems. Yeah, we're there. We're trying to strengthen this. We're trying to strengthen that. But it's not the thinking. And part of the problem with the thinking, and that's my second point, is it's very relational. And I really like the comment about let's engage first and analyze second, because it's really about that relationship you have across where you as a mission director, where you choose to put your time. The ambassador can often help you in that, because he's got very good contacts, and trying to figure out, okay, where are the areas? I mean, obviously we work a lot in health, so you're going to try to get to know and understand that sector a lot if it's a FTF country working that sector. The private sector in Indonesia, it was amazing to me when I got there how little we had worked with the private sector. And these are you know, Carnegies and Rockefellers of Indonesia. These guys have money. And yet we have hardly talked to any of them about how their foundations might do more development work, how they themselves, maybe their interest. We've got some of the palm oil powers to be interested in the deforestation issues in the sustainable supply chain initiative. But it's that you know, getting out of the office, you know, it's not, as I repeated so many times to project managers, you know, it's not your one counterpart in the ministry and a couple of partner NGO or contractor partners. There's a whole world out there of people interested in what you're doing or have interest in what you're doing. And so that relational aspect, I can't, even with the embassy, who feels a meeting with the government's about, you know, getting information and reporting on it or delivering a demarche. I mean, you know, there's a lot more there that we need to learn when we're meeting with the government. And then the final point that I liked so much was about the, you know, the avoiding proceduralism, prepackaged assistance, you know, mixing this financial accountability with the broader accountability, and ensuring that that while we, since we're talking about a 5-to-10-year effort here, that we need to work a lot more on benchmarks and metrics of capacity building or institution building or country systems development. I certainly agree with the capacity building becoming a bottomless pit. Everybody's doing it, but nobody's measuring it. You know, I get no sense of, well, what's our end point on capacity? When can we say capacity has been built or a country system is operating, and where are we on that line? So that's a very important point. Finally, one just added thing that I would add to this is this effort at outreach. I think a couple of people mentioned. I mean, when we talk about USAID Forward, we talk about country systems. You know, our embassies don't understand it. Many of our partners don't understand it. I think the government partners, I think we need to do a lot more in terms of outreach and to broaden that and deepen that dialogue with others about what we mean by that and how important that is to our development work. Thank you.
Thank you. Before I turn to Susan, just a couple of quick public service announcements. One, Nancy mentioned resilience. we're going to be launching next week. Again, I want to encourage all of you to read the document and also the discussions that we're going to be generating as part of that launch. And then since we're trying to balance internal and external, and since Glenn mentioned Dana Brown's work on the listening project, that also will be launching, I think, next week. And it's an effort at several thousand communications between the folks who've been organizing the project and various beneficiaries, organizations, institutions. And again, as I think Glenn highlighted, there's a wealth of information, and we were fortunate enough to hear some previews from that from Dana earlier yesterday. So let me turn now to Susan. Generally, you know, your reactions, but also I think picking up on Glenn's point about strategic communications, which I know you're thinking always a lot about, and how we integrate that into our follow-up to the conference, but also, what changes? You know, what is what you heard require changes in what we do?
Can I just, unfortunately, Maura and I have to go. We're launching tonight a very exciting partnership, which is our Greening the Supply Chain partnership, where we have linked up with 450 private companies around the world in the Consumer Goods Forum. They have sales of a total of $3 trillion, and they have agreed at Rio de Janeiro, at the Rio Plus 20, to eliminate deforestation from their supply chains for paper, palm oil, cattle, and soybeans by the year 2020. Not a single penny of U.S. government money, but it's going to dramatically change the environment out there. And I was talking earlier about convening authority. Well, the real reason that they did it is they got invited to come here to Washington and sit with people from the White House, which, as I've often said, the White House is the single greatest home court advantage in the world. And so Maura and I have to go brief our administrator, who's going to be speaking to this group this evening. But again, I just wanted to say thank you so much. This has been a fabulous session, and I know it's going to have repercussions and ripples throughout USAID for weeks and months to come. So thank you.
Thank you, Don, for joining us for this session. So, Susan, turn it over to you.
Great. Well, I think that's a great segue into just some final comments I'll make, because the first point I wanted to make was something we heard yesterday from our mission director in India about reaching beyond our comfort zone. And that's really, if we talk about systems, particularly for AID, but for all of us who are involved in development, it's listening, and it's sitting down with people who we don't normally sit down with. It's those groups who often don't have a seat at the table, whether they're marginalized groups or vulnerable communities, or those who just have never been able to be part of the process. So when we bring it home to what we do, whether it's the private sector companies that Maura and Don were just talking about, but then how do you take this conceptually down to the reality of what are we doing differently? So, for example, in our strategy process, a big part of that process that Glenn and others who have been in the field most recently, Aaron, you heard from this morning, it's really sitting down and listening and having different people at the tables to help us think through those problems. And I think a point that you all made this afternoon in particular, that doesn't mean we do everything. That means we have to choose what is our comparative advantage, where can we really focus, and how do we, as somebody put on the table, this is really about thinking differently in the sense of our transition as donors, as partners, and where do we want to help that country get to? If you really, you know, go back to the president's policy directive, he was very clear when he talked about and with other host country governments as well as civil society, nobody wants to be dependent upon aid. So as we're thinking about strategies, and someone talked about transition strategies today, actually within AID right now, we're talking about transformational strategies. How can we be part of that larger system that country is transforming, and eventually we would be working ourselves out of a job. Again, getting back to the president's policy directive about being more selective about where we work and more focused about what we work in. So that was one of my sort of favorite quotes, and I think how we're thinking about doing business differently. The second was about how there's whether I think we started by saying 1,000 years of experience or 1,500 years of experience in this room, but just the learning, and that's really what this whole experience summit was about, was learning from that experience, and not just, again, this is only just one part of a larger process. And as Dirk put on the table yesterday, when we talk about monitoring and evaluation in this space, we need to trust appropriately but verify rapidly, and how important that cycle of learning is just constant. And so really look forward to continuing that. And it's not just about the numbers. I was actually really pleased yesterday that I didn't hear the 30% number mentioned once, because that's not what this is really about. That's one element, of course, but that the narratives behind that, the relationships, as we've been talking about, are absolutely key. And yet we do need to have the metrics on capacity building and how we think about this, and how do we actually work ourselves into a different relationship with a country and engage with them. And most importantly, how we communicate about this, to really take some ownership of this. I don't think we in USAID maybe have communicated as well as we should have about really what did we mean by implementation procurement reform. And so we really look at this as an opportunity for reframing that discussion and that dialogue, and obviously all of us being in this together. The third quote I liked yesterday in particular was that organizational change really matters. There are oftentimes when we're looking for that technical solution, I think the example that was used was tax administration, right? And that was perfect. We put out an RFA. We said we want the best experts on tax administration. And yet really what we're talking about is institutional change and organizational change. And so how we actually go about that and really look at it, within our own space with our projects as we're doing project design. And it's not just about the money, as so many of you pointed out. It is about the policy coherence. It's about the dialogue. It's about the convening authority. It's about how do we actually sit at the table with our counterparts, and not always the government. I was a bit chagrined to hear that some people thought when this experience summit was about country system strengthening, it was only about government to government. It's about relationships, about whole of society, and how we sit down and actually design our projects that take into account all of those different elements. So that we can really move forward on organizational, institutional change, which is just enormous. And then finally, another favorite quote, which I told John, and he obviously used it, was that donors are part of the system. And I think we often, whether we're donors or partners, we often think of ourselves as outside of the system, and yet we're very much, as again Dirk highlighted with his graphic of all the different not just donors, but really players in the development space. And we need to think about ourselves within that system. And so to end on that note, that's why I'm so excited about this, because as one donor representative, that we have a responsibility then to be able to have much clearer policy and strategy guidance within the space. And that's really, as Larry and Chip and Gary and others have been articulating, why this is so important, because you've helped us at least create the foundation in order for us to articulate more clearly our strategic direction as we move forward. So I just want to close by not only thanking the organizers who spent a tremendous amount of time, Gary, Chip, and Larry, but so many others, mostly your time. 2 days is an awful lot to ask from this esteemed group of colleagues, whether it's 1,000 years or 1,500 years, but it just dramatically helps move us forward, so thank you.
Thanks, Susan. A big hand for our executive panel. I don't know if Nancy, go ahead.
Okay. Reagan Building, we will be launching the resilience policy and program guidance, and that is a very concrete expression of how we're doing business differently, so that we can be more iterative, more flexible, and more systems focused in our approach. Join us.
Thank you. Anyone else on the panel have anything else they want to add before we close? Okay. Well, I also just want to thank all the folks who were here for this entire 2 days, or even parts of the 2 days. It was an incredibly rich experience. We've gained tremendous amount. We are going to quickly move to try to synthesize what we heard and feed it back to you and within the agency, because we really, you know, appreciate that this is not going to happen just magically. If the process that, you know, we were part of today is going to have some longer term impact, we need to keep thinking about and moving forward and not being afraid to take some risks. So again, thanks to everyone for participating, and look forward to keeping in touch as we move this thing forward.